Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello, everyone. Dr. Rob Meter here, and glad you could tune in today to another episode 68 of the Smart Family Podcast. Hey, I really hope that after this many episodes, you actually feel a bit smarter, whether as parents or partners or whatever life circumstance you find yourself in. We really do want these episodes to be useful and educational and hopefully spur you on to further research or reading yourself to perhaps make some changes in how you parent or in your relationship with your partner or in your own life in a positive way that will help you love being home. That is truly our hope. Well, today we cover a topic that certainly generated a lot of interest initially when we spoke to ADHD expert Dr. Russell Barkley on episode 28. And the replay of that episode, which was number 56. And the reason we replayed that was because the original episode quickly became our second most popular episode on the show, which tells me that this is something that really resonated with you. So I was really happy when Dr. Walt Karniski agreed to come on the podcast. I found his book on ADHD medications so practical and useful and balanced that I wanted him to come and talk with us today about the topic of ADHD and its treatment. I know in my practice, kids and parents come in literally daily wondering if they have this diagnosis and what can be done about the inattention and hyperactivity, which seems to be getting in the way of optimal function, whether that's at school, at work, or at home. At the same time, this is a diagnosis that also gets a lot of press simply due to the fact that many people don't believe in the diagnosis or are skeptical about the role of pharmaceutical companies when they promote medications. And certainly, it is easy to get cynical and wonder, is this even a real thing? Are these medications really safe? Do they work? So I hear everything from ADHD is overdiagnosed to ADHD is underdiagnosed to ADHD does not even exist. Well, I love tackling these questions head on with patients and really being upfront about the symptoms of ADHD, the treatments, etc. And I was so pleased that Dr. Karniski took the same approach in his practice and in his book. I really enjoyed the real life examples in his book and the stories he uses to illustrate his points and, quite frankly, really simplify things. So if you're interested in learning more about this, go to ADHDmedicationbook.com. And we will also repeat that information at the end of the podcast today. Dr. Karniski's words of wisdom come from years of experience. And Dr. Karniski is now retired, but he is a developmental pediatrician who really knows his stuff and is eager to talk about this topic. I reached him today in Florida, so please join me for this conversation with Dr. Walt Karniski. Dr. Karniski, thank you so much for joining us today on the Smart Family Podcast. Let's start off. Can you maybe just mention how you got into this field? You've been in developmental pediatrics for a while now, and you have a great interest in ADHD. You've written an excellent book on it called ADHD Medications. And when I saw that, I was just keen to interview you to talk about ADHD because it's a topic that comes up a lot. How did you get into this field? And maybe just introduce yourself by, you know, your background and what you are currently doing in treating mental health.
I've been practicing for about 40 years. I initially did my training in Boston, primarily with children with learning disabilities and other mild to moderate behavioral and developmental problems. I then joined the University of South Florida for about a 10-year stint, and I was the director of the developmental program there. I left the university and then started two schools for working with children with ADHD. And those schools, one of them, Tampa Day School, has grown to about 150 students, and it's a fully functioning program as well. So I'm pretty proud of that, of those programs as well. As far as how I got into this, I don't really know the answer to that. When I started out in medicine, I was immediately drawn to pediatrics. And when I got into pediatrics, I really liked the developmental aspect or the way of looking at children's development. And I felt that that was really the centerpiece of pediatrics, no matter what field you're in, whether you're a neurologist or cardiologist or a developmental pediatrician. So I've enjoyed the 40 years and probably seen 5,000 children over that time and have a great deal of thanks for all that they've taught me in the process.
No, that's great. I just so appreciate the developmental perspective as well, because as a pediatrician, I think that's really important to bring into the conversation, just to see like how do these issues develop over time and how do they change as kids develop? You know, we know that there's, of course, a massive amount of brain growth that happens in the early years before they head off to school. And then sometimes in school, we see some of these issues really crystallize. And one of those is ADHD, which is what I want to really talk to you about today. And so I want to just draw upon your really decades of experience in the fact that, which you've just written about in your book called ADHD Medications. But let's start just with the very beginning. How is ADHD diagnosed? Like, are there specific tests or questionnaires that can be done for that? And is that required to make the diagnosis? And maybe just start with that.
All right. First place, ADHD is different from many other medical conditions. Let's take leukemia for just a moment here. Let's take stroke. Can you imagine any situation where you would have trouble speaking, your words would be garbled, your eyes were not focusing and were moving in different directions, your gait was off and you couldn't actually stand? Anyone could say that that's a normal process? And the answer is clearly no. None of those behaviors are normal. And yet every one of the behaviors that are used to make the diagnosis of ADHD are normal behaviors in some people some of the time. So some of those behaviors are distractibility, difficulty concentrating, forgetting things easily, lack of organization, not planning for the future. And every one of us have experienced every one of those behaviors, at least occasionally in our lives, but they don't dominate our lives. In children with ADHD, they dominate their lives. But it's important to understand that every one of those behaviors are normal behaviors if they occur occasionally and once in a while. And I think that's what has led to the whole feeling that ADHD is a manufactured diagnosis and overdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. In addition, let me explain how I do not see ADHD as a disease in the same way that stroke is a disease or pneumonia. I see it as a change in how human beings have evolved over time. And let me explain what I mean by that. Let's go back 100,000 years and pretend that you were a caveman and your job is to go out and pick berries for the tribe's breakfast every morning. And one morning you're hunched over a bush, picking berries, putting them in your leather satchel, and all of a sudden you hear a rustling in the bushes behind you. What should you do? What would you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you'd look around quickly and see what that is and
exactly.
What's causing that noise.
Okay. You would be distracted from picking berries by the sound behind you. But it would behoove you to turn and make sure that it's not a saber-toothed tiger. And if it is a saber-toothed tiger, you would pull your knife or run. But at least either way, you'd get back to the cave, you'd father more children, and you'd carry the distractibility gene to the next generation. But if you weren't distracted, you might be the saber-toothed tiger's lunch. You would never have another child again. And you would not carry any distractibility gene to the next generation. So my feeling about this is the distractibility and difficulty concentrating and difficulty focusing were actually behaviors that kept us alive for 100,000 years. And suddenly things changed in the 19th century when we forced children to go back or go to school. These were children that used to get their education from their father's blacksmith shop or from the farm that they worked on. But now they were put in schools, asked to sit in chairs, keep their hands still, stand in line. And the neurology was just not made for that. Some children are able to do that really well, and they excel in school. But the children who would have been leaders of their tribe 100,000 years ago are now having difficulty. So, but having said all this, let me not mistake or the fact that ADHD is a neurologic condition, but it's not necessarily a neurologic disease. Does that make sense?
So what you're totally, yeah, no, what you're saying is that it's an essentially a leftover condition from that served us very well 100,000 years ago, let's say, but in today's world is not necessary anymore. In fact, is maladaptive in many situations today. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Exactly. And I basically see children with ADHD as being a mismatch between their abilities and their strengths and their talents versus the environment that they're living in. 100,000 years ago, the environment was perfect for them, mm-hmm. and they excelled and they became leaders of their tribe. But nowadays, the same behaviors result in failure in the classroom, lack of self-esteem, difficulty forming appropriate friendships, and basically a very difficult life as adults if it's not treated appropriately.
Uh-huh. And so why do we think then that it's so much more common now than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago? We do see the incidence, as literature comes out, I think it's 5 to 6% of the population now would meet criteria for a diagnosis of ADHD. Is that because we are just better at picking it up, or is our world just getting more complicated that these symptoms are just more noticeable?
I think your postulate that we're better at picking it up is valid. And I think that's part of the answer to your question. However, a different way of answering your question is to say, well, it's really not that much more common than it was back in the 1980s and 70s. In the book that I wrote, ADHD Medication, Does It Work and Is It Safe? I described what happened in the 1970s when an article was published in the Omaha Tribune stating that 40% of children that were in the public schools in Omaha were on medication for ADHD. That later proved to be inaccurate, but it resulted in congressional hearings. It resulted in boosting up the FDA's ability to monitor what happens with medication and how safe they are. So it resulted in a lot of changes. And that was back in 1980 when people at that point were concerned that ADHD was being overdiagnosed. So I don't know that it's necessarily a new diagnosis. And we even have descriptions going back to the 18th century of children who appear to have ADHD as well.
Right. Yeah. And I really appreciate how in your book you just outlined a history of the concept of ADHD and how, you know, it's currently formulated in today's world. And because one of the things that I hear people say a lot, and maybe it ties into what you've just mentioned, is how we are pathologizing normal behavior. But what you're in a sense saying is, by saying it's not really a disease, it's hard to say it's pathology then, right? It's more, this is just an inability or difficulty in adapting to our current modern situation, and that's causing difficulties.
Exactly.
Okay.
I might add one more thing one more story about that. I love telling stories. About 5 years ago, I went to see my dermatologist. I see the dermatologist every 6 months. And that particular day, he was out of town. So I saw his assistant. And she walks in the room. She looks at my chart and says, "Oh, you're Dr. Karniski?" She said, "What kind of medicine do you practice?" And I said, "Well, I'm a developmental pediatrician. I see children with ADHD, autism, cerebral palsy, learning disabilities, anxiety, and that kind of thing. And she said, oh, ADHD, that's overdiagnosed, isn't it? And I looked at her and I said, well, let me answer your question by posing another question. What is the incidence of skin cancer in people over the age of 70? And she said, it's around 12 to 14%. And I said, 12 to 14%, that's really pretty high. Skin cancer must be overdiagnosed then. And she said, no, skin cancer isn't overdiagnosed. It's just that people don't take care of their skin. They expose themselves to sun, they get sunburns, and that predisposes them to cancer. Well, wait a minute, I see what you're trying to do here. And I think it really is important to keep that story in mind when you think about the overdiagnosis of ADHD. The prevalence of a disorder, or how often it occurs in our society, does not tell us anything about the validity of that diagnosis. So if it occurs in my practice, when I see a child, I'm concerned about determining whether the incidence of ADHD is either 0% or 100%, because I've only got one patient that I'm concerned about, the one that's sitting in front of me that morning. And either that child has ADHD or does not have ADHD. There's no in between. And as a result, that's my job, is to determine whether it's present in that child. And I can't think about how many other children it's occurring in. If you went home tonight and your wife told you that Ed across the street was diagnosed with leukemia, and then you said, but I just heard that Joan down the street was also diagnosed with leukemia. And then your wife says, yeah, and on top of that, the couple that's living next door, both of them have leukemia. Would you worry that leukemia is being overdiagnosed in your neighborhood, or would you worry about what's in the water and the telephone lines behind your house? So again, right, the prevalence of a disorder has nothing to do with its validity. ADHD does occur in 7 to 8% of the population. That's been shown to be true using many different ways of diagnosing ADHD and across many different countries as well. The same prevalence is found in most other countries as well.
Are there, different paths or different ways to get to inattention and hyperactivity? For example, if a child's up playing video games all night, it's no wonder they're going to be inattentive and, lack focus the next day at school. Or if they're, undergoing, say there's trauma at home or the parents are separating, of course they're going to be inattentive because they're going to be distracted thinking about sort of other issues in their life at that time. Does a child like that meet criteria for ADHD, or do we have to look at sort of what is the cause of that of the diagnosis?
Well, okay. First place, the other things that you mentioned, the problems going on at home, watching video games, and so on. Yes, those instances can cause some ADHD behaviors, but that's why we sit and take a half hour to an hour history from the family, as opposed to a 5-minute history about your ear infection. I usually spend about an hour talking to the family about what their daily life is like, when the symptoms first started, what causes the symptoms to get worse, what causes them to get better. And all of that I put together to develop a diagnosis of ADHD. So not only do we need to see the behaviors of ADHD, but we also need to make sure that those symptoms and those behaviors are not caused by any other medical condition. Thyroid problems can cause ADHD-like behaviors. Hearing loss can cause some of those behaviors as well. So there's many other medical conditions that could cause the same behaviors, and it behooves us as pediatricians to make sure that that's been ruled out before we think about medication treatment.
That's great. That's good to know. It's good to kind of take a whole view of the child and the situation they find themselves in, you know, their environment, to make sure that we're really coming up with the right diagnosis and help for that child, right?
Absolutely.
So let's look at medications then, because I think that's something that parents have a lot of questions about. There are so many out there, and I know that you're in the U.S., I'm in Canada, so the medications are similar, the names are similar, but there might be some differences there as well, depending on what our, you know, respective health agencies have approved. But, you know, there here in Canada, we have everything from Vyvanse, Concerta, Bifenton, Adderall, Ritalin, Dexedrine, you know, Intuniv, Strattera. Like I could, you know, that's a pretty exhaustive list already, but there's more out there than that. That can be so confusing for parents. And I like how you, in your book, have really simplified the picture for us. And I wonder if you could just do that today, maybe give us a bit of perspective on ADHD medications in a nutshell when you're presenting this to a patient maybe who might need treatment or benefit from treatment. Where do you start with explaining this, you know, large array of medications that are available?
Well, first, I've done a number of interviews, and you've done the best job of itemizing the different medications used to treat ADHD. Most people that I talk to can come up with 3 or 4 medications. You came up with about 10 to 12. In actuality, there are 46 medications approved by the FDA in the United States for the treatment of ADHD, and no doubt there will be more approved. And yet 36 of those 46 medications are called stimulant medications. And these stimulants are really represent only 2 generic medications, methylphenidate and amphetamine. And all of the different medications that you mentioned, plus all of the others that you did not mention, are simply different ways of preparing the medication to give different characteristics to the medication, but it's still, the bottom line is it's still the same medication, and what gets to the brain is exactly the same from medication to medication for all 36 of those 46 medications. Now, the non-stimulants is a whole nother issue, and we can probably get into that at some other point. But the stimulants really represent only 2 medications, amphetamine and methylphenidate. However, the changes that pharmaceutical companies have made accomplish 2 things. So some of those changes are Ritalin was an excellent medication for treating ADHD, but it only lasted 3 to 4 hours. And so we had to give at least 2 and sometimes 3 doses a day. That caused an up and down effect of the medication and led to moodiness and irritability from the medication. It was seen as a side effect, but it was really an effect of the way the medication was prescribed so far apart. So the pharmaceutical companies have come up with many long lasting preparations of the medication, a capsule that lasts 8 to 9 hours, a liquid that lasts 9 to 10 hours, a skin patch that lasts 15 hours, and many other medications like that. So that 2 things happen because of all of those changes. First is the pharmaceutical companies were able to charge 10 times as much for a medication because it has a brand name now. And yet it's offered nothing different than the same substance that was in Ritalin and was available for 1/10 of the cost. So that was the first thing that happened. But the second thing that was happened, because everything that the pharmaceutical companies did was legal, they just found ways around it to get the FDA to approve the medication as a new medication, even though it wasn't new. But in addition, in the process, they created an avenue for pediatricians to tailor the dose specific for each child. So some children cannot swallow a pill, or especially a capsule. So we've got now liquid preparations, orally dissolving pills, chewable tablets, and pills themselves. And what that whole process has done is given the ability, given us the ability to tailor treatment specific for each child.
Uh-huh. And so they all would still, you know, bottom line, have similar side effects then. Exactly. You know, the pharmacokinetics are, yeah, right. So, and so what are the common side effects that parents might look out for with these medications, with the stimulant medications?
Well, the two most common side effects, well, actually, before I talk about the side effects, let me back up and say that there are three kinds of side effects. And I think it's important, even as a parent, let alone the pediatrician, but it's apparent to understand these different kinds of side effects. The first type of side effect is what I call a time-related side effect. And those side effects, for instance, occur when the medication's wearing off or when the medication's first taking effect in the morning and the brain is suddenly getting hit with this medication that had been cleared from the system. So the most important thing a parent can do is determine when the side effects are occurring, and that will help the pediatrician identify what's actually causing the side effects. If they're occurring at 4 o'clock during the day and the child is on Concerta, Concerta lasts about 10 hours. If you take a dose at 7 in the morning, it's going to wear off around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so what the parents may be seeing is not a side effect of the medication, but the medication wearing off. And it's important to make that distinction. The second type of side effect is a dose-related side effect. Children that are on not enough medication or on too much medication can get emotional reactions to the medication as well. Too much medication causes children, what parents are concerned about is the zombie effect, which causes children to be quiet and serious, which is not necessarily a problem in the classroom, but then is a problem when the children are playing at home. Actually, along that line, I one time had a parent come in and tell me I had just diagnosed the child with ADHD 2 weeks before, started on medication, and this was the first visit back. And the mother said, that medication's working really well in school. He's getting good grades. His teacher said he's behaving perfectly, but I think he's depressed. And I said, really? Okay. Why do you think he's depressed? And she said, well, he comes home every night. He drops his book bag on the floor, walks to his room, and reads for 2 hours. And I said, yes, and what's wrong with that? And she said, well, he never did that before. He was the kid that would always run in the room, jump up and down on the couch, knock over the lamp, pull the cat's tail. The cat would run around the room, and he would go chasing after the cat. And that was our day all day long. So for him to sit and read for 2 hours, he must be depressed.
Right.
And so I said to her, no, I think what you're seeing is what your child would have been like. Well, actually, let me back up and say, I then asked her, I said, well, if your child had been born with a fascination for reading and he read 2 hours a night at that point, would you be concerned about him? And she said, well, no, of course not. And I said, then what you were seeing is what your child would have been if he didn't have ADHD.
Right.
And she looked at me and said, oh, I understand. And suddenly understood the process. There's many other stories very similar to that. So you asked me the question, what are the most common side effects from the medication? The two most common side effects are decreased appetite and difficulty falling asleep. And both those side effects are time-related and dose-related side effects, meaning that if you give more medication, then the child's going to have more difficulty falling asleep and more trouble eating, especially at noon, if you're taking a long-acting medication that's lasting all day. So it's important to distinguish between, again, what times those effects occur. And there's many, I will say this about the side effects. There is no side effect from the stimulant medications that is serious or long-term. Every one of the side effects that do occur can be reversed and definitely go away when the medication has stopped.
That's good to know.
And so the first two side effects the difficulty sleeping, and the appetite problems generally can be treated by adjusting the dose of the medication or the timing of the medication. So that, for instance, if the family eats dinner at 6 o'clock, you might want to get a medication that lasts till 5 o'clock. So it's wearing off at the time dinner hits, and then to take another dose of the short acting pill at 6:30 so that he can do his homework, and it wears off in 3 to 4 hours so he can sleep.
Right.
So again, right. Knowing how long a medication lasts and when the side effects are occurring is critical to understanding what's causing the side effect. In addition, side effects affect mood, and the two mood side effects are irritability, which usually occurs when the medication wears off, again, a time-related side effect, or a subdued nature, which the parents call the zombie effect, and that occurs usually from too much medication. So again, Think about that. That's not really an indictment against the medications. It's an indictment about the way we prescribe those medications. And it behooves us to make sure that we're prescribing the medication so that it's effective when they need to be effective and out of the system when they don't need to be effective.
Yeah. How do the medications actually work? Because it's people think, well, stimulant, that's kind of strange because you don't want to stimulate the child. So it seems like kind of a funny name for a medication for an ADHD condition. But tell us how on what part of the brain, like what actually happens in the brain when we take a stimulant medication?
There are 100 billion nerve cells in the average child's brain. There's 7 billion people on the face of the earth. So that would be like each person representing a nerve cell on 14 different earths. Now, imagine if those 100 billion people on those 14 earths had 10,000 Facebook friends, and they sent a message to all of those Facebook friends at the same time. Every one of those 100 billion people sent 10,000 messages at the same time. Well, all the computers in the world would crash at that point. And yet that's what happens in the developing child's brain almost every second. There are 100 billion nerve cells in the brain and 10,000 connections from every nerve cell to other nerve cells. At the point of the connection, the nerve cells do not actually touch. There is an open space there. And what happens is the sending nerve cell sends a chemical substance to the receiving nerve cell. And when the receiving nerve cell picks up that substance, it moves it into the nerve cell on a receptor. It's almost like a key unlocking a lock. And that allows that receiving nerve cell to get the message and then become part of that process as well. And that happens hundreds of thousands, millions of times every second. Now, but if you've been listening to what I just said, there's a problem with what I just described. And that is that if that chemical is fixing and attaching to the receiving nerve cell and it stays there, then that nerve cell can only get one message in its entire lifetime because that chemical is now blocking things. So there's another chemical in that space which kicks off the first chemical, sends it back to the sending nerve cell, and the sending nerve cell reabsorbs it and uses it again to send another message. Okay. And what happens with ADHD is that chemical that is knocking the transmitter off its received nerve cell, that chemical is over-efficient. It's working too well. And so what we need to do is slow it down so that it's taking the nerve cell, taking the chemical off the nerve cell and allowing the nerve cell to receive the next message, but not doing it too fast. And what the stimulants do is that they stimulate that nerve cell to slow down, or that protein to slow down. Yeah. And in the process, even though it's a stimulant, it is stimulating a part of the brain whose job it is to slow things down.
I see.
And so it's called a stimulant, and it works chemically as a stimulant, but its behavioral effect is to reduce not to reduce stimulation, but to allow a child to respond to stimulation in an appropriate way.
Right. So it stimulates a part of the brain that is responsible for your level of activity or hyperactivity, and it slows it down enough so that the activity level, for example, is not hyperactive anymore. It's normal activity level. Is that sort of a way to think about it?
Exactly. Yes, it is. The other thing that's important to understand, remember when we were talking earlier about the cavemen, I said that ADHD is not a neurologic disease, but it is a neurologic condition. And so what I mean by that is what's causing the behaviors is happening in the brain, but it is a problem only because of the mismatch of the expectations of the society around that child.
Right. Yes. Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad you clarified that.
I want to point out that there's further evidence that the brain is involved in ADHD, and that comes from MRI and PET brain scan studies. So these studies are fascinating because what they initially showed us was informative, but the follow-up studies were amazing. And let me explain what I mean by that. The initial studies looked at children with ADHD, and they scanned the brains, and then they compared those scans to children who did not have ADHD. What they found was that in three areas of the brain, the brain was smaller in those three areas, the caudate nucleus, the frontal cerebellar striations, and the frontal lobe. And those three areas were smaller in children with ADHD. That would indicate, and those areas of the brain, by the way, are important for learning, memory, organization, and planning. So everything fits. Okay. However, what came next is even more fascinating. And that is that when the children grew up to be adults, they were brought back to be studied again. And they divided that group up into the adults who had been treated as children and adults who had not been treated as children. And then they scanned the brains again. And what they found was that the adults who had ADHD as children but had been treated with medication as children had normal-sized areas of the brain of those three areas. In other words, it looks like that using those areas kind of enhances the part of the brain in the same way that exercise enhances muscle development. So that as you use something, it grows in the brain. And so what it looks like, and I do have to admit that this has not been proven yet, but it's beginning to look like medication is actually reversing some of that process, allowing the brain in those areas to function normally. And once it functions normally, it continues to grow and express that behavior in the proper and appropriate way. And that's pretty astounding, really. I didn't know about these studies until about 7 or 8 years ago. And when I found out about it, I was just really floored over because I usually got parents asking me the question, well, I know he needs medication. I know he has ADHD. But what happens if he's been on this medication for 20 years? What happens to the brain? And for a long time, I didn't really have a good answer. Now I have an excellent answer. Is not only does it not harm the brain, but there's evidence that it is actually improving brain function and changing brain structure.
Well, it's interesting to think about that because we know the brain is a very, what we call, plastic organ. It has an ability to change with experience and with use of certain areas. And I often talk with families about, you know, upward spirals and downward spirals. If you have positive experiences, you know, that changes your brain. And if you have negative experiences, that changes your brain as well. And I wonder if treating ADHD, whether we do that through, you know, medication or other means, you know, other ways of helping the child, that will just lead to positive experiences and will lead to actual changes in how the brain works. And presumably, we can pick that up on some of these really sharp imaging techniques that are out there nowadays. So I just feel like it just highlights the importance of addressing these behaviors, and medication, as we were just talking about, is one of them. But are there other ways, though, of treating ADHD? A lot of parents ask about, are there other natural remedies? Are there foods? Are there other things that I can do to help my child function when they have symptoms of ADHD?
At one point, I kept a folder in my file cabinet at home. And every time I learned of a new treatment, I put things in that folder. And at one point, I pulled that folder out and looked through it, and I must have found 25 different treatments that had been recommended, including cutting the pine bark off of certain trees that only grew in France and crushing those into pills, as well as the eliminating fluorescent lighting in the classrooms. Of course, the dietary changes and the supplemental substances that are used. The problem with all of those behaviors, all of those supposed treatments, is that one or two of them or some of them may actually work. But because the research on them is so paltry, we have very little understanding of what it does. Most of the research is short-term, meaning that two groups of children are compared with, say, for instance, biofeedback, those that get the biofeedback and those that don't. And then a few hours after that, their ability to focus and concentrate is compared. But what the studies don't do is follow the children long term. What happens after they stop the intervention and 2 years later? What few studies have been done have shown that most of those interventions do not work long term. I'll admit that not all of them have been studied, and I'm not aware of everything that's out there. And something may work, and we may find something in the future. The one thing that two things that I do recommend. First is executive function training. Executive function is that ability to focus and to plan for the future, to prepare for the future. And that future may simply be getting an assignment on Tuesday that a book report is due on Friday, and making sure that you get your book read and the book report written by Friday. And just managing your time is what executive function is all about. So I do feel that executive function training is helpful, because what medication does, medication helps us concentrate and focus, but it doesn't tell us what to concentrate and focus on. Whereas the training gives us the training to focus on those things that are helpful and productive in our lives, but the medication is almost like opening the door and allowing us to get to the other room so that we can participate in that therapy. So what we found is that if you try those therapies in a child with ADHD without medication, even though they work when children with medication, they don't work very well in children who are not on medication. If they can't focus and can't learn, they're not going to learn those interventions either. So what we found in most cases is it's beneficial to start them on medication, find the appropriate dose, get them stabilized, and then bring in the additional therapies. And that may be in school therapies or at home or out in somebody's office.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that and recognizing. And also, I think we always need to be humble about the fact that, you know, new things may be out there, and we may discover, another therapy one day that works as well or better than what we're using now. And always having an open mind is useful. And, I never try to just dismiss things that patients bring to me to review and look at. I think everything, you know, we sure can have an open mind and say, let's have a look at it and what's the actual evidence, and then go from there. So, but for now, it does seem like in terms of effect size, stimulant medications do seem to be the first line when it comes to treating the core symptoms of ADHD. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I agree. Yes.
Well, Dr. Kuniski, I know we can talk about this probably for another hour. we didn't even talk about the non-stimulant medications yet, and maybe we'll have to do that someday. But I do know you have a chapter on that in your book as well. And just for those people that might want to read more and learn more about this or review some of the things that we talked about today, can you just tell us the title of the book you've written and where people could find it and perhaps other resources related to the diagnosis of ADHD?
Yes, the book is entitled ADHD Medication, Does It Work and Is It Safe? It's available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. It's also available through the publisher, Roman and Littlefield.
Dr. Karnisky, thank you so much for spending your time with us today and for sharing your expertise. I know many of our listeners will definitely appreciate it. So thank you, and I wish you all the best in your retirement.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, and look forward to maybe talking again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, that was so great. I really love that conversation with Dr. Karnisky today. I love the practical examples and illustrations he uses to get his point across. And although I work in this field every day as a pediatrician, I loved how he conceptualized ADHD, not so much as a disease or a disorder, but really as almost a remnant way in which the brain in some individuals is sort of stuck in a way of operating that was highly adaptive eons ago, but less adaptive in today's environment, to the point where in many people, children and adults, it can really cause problems. Well, I take that message and take it a step further and say to myself and to my patients, you know, are there ways in which we can modify or accommodate a child who might be prone to distractibility so that it does not cause as many problems? And then look at ways we can modify the school or home environment and at the same time consider how we might improve the way the brain functions so that this distractibility is dampened just enough to improve day-to-day functioning. I also love Dr. Karnisky's nutshell of the complexity of the brain. It really is such a powerful and complicated organ. It literally blows my mind every time I hear those sorts of examples and illustrations. And it blows my mind just as much when we think of the power we have to modify and improve our brains so that we can function better in today's world and have more positive and growth-oriented experiences. Love it. Well, that's it for today. Again, read more about this in Dr. Karnisky's book, ADHD Medication, Does It Work and Is It Safe?, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And also check out the super useful and practical website, ADHDmedicationbook.com. Well, please do join us next time on the Smart Family Podcast. In the meantime, please share this episode with your friends and leave us a review if you found this useful. It's easy. Just go to Apple Podcasts, go to the show and scroll down past the episodes to where it says ratings and reviews and give us a rating and leave a review. That would be so awesome and would raise the profile of the show so that others might also benefit from it and help them to love being home. Bye for now.